says. And so Helmut does not give up hope as he prays. O my heavenly Father, if it be possible, open the minds and hearts of these people. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. He feels something. His chest swells. A warm calmness fills him. God is listening. Of this Helmut is sure. He squeezes his eyes tighter, repeats the last words, chants them fervently, as thou wilt, as thou wilt, as thou wilt, until they wrap around him, and the floating feeling comes. It's April 1935, and spring has come to Hamburg. Helmut hears it in the crackling gray ice floes that drift through the rivers and narrow canals. He sees it in the mallard ducks that bob bottoms up in the Alster Lake and in the Return of the Robin. Helmut sees spring in Muti's eyes, too. She has a new boyfriend, the tall, dark-haired, mustachioed Hugo Hubener. Muti stays out late dancing with Hugo, and some mornings when Helmut awakens, Muti is humming in the kitchen, and Hugo is sitting at their table. He wears his brown and black SS uniform with its blue collar insignia that says he's a Rotenführer, a non-commissioned corporal. Before long, the Rotenführer is sitting at their table every morning, taking up all the air in the flat. He stretches out, clasps his hands behind his head, elbows wide, and crosses his gleaming black jackboots at the ankles, saying, "The Führer this, and the Führer that." Without asking, Hugo turns in Muti's old radio for a new people's receiver, the Volksempfunger VE-301. It is a cheap brown plastic radio with a simple dial and no shortwave so that it only receives German stations. "See," says Hugo proudly, "the 301 stands for January 30th, the day Hitler became our leader. Thanks to the Führer, every German can afford a new radio. All of Germany can tune in the Führer." It grinds Helmut's stomach the way Hugo makes all the decisions, as if he is the father. He decides what Muti will make for breakfast and dinner, and asks Helmut if his homework is done. And now Hugo has even decided on the radio. Helmut cannot understand what Muti sees in a man like Hugo, but Hugo seems here to stay. And stay he does. By 1937, Hugo has moved in with them, and one morning he announces in his booming voice that the flat is too small. There's not enough Lebensraum, Hitler's favorite word, for living space. "All Germans need Lebensraum," Hugo says. "I have found us a new flat, Emma. We are moving." And just like that, Muti packs up everything. The dishes, the pots and pans, the uneven chairs, the brown wooden table, the worn armchair, the scratched-up black oak table lamp, the two wooden bedsteads. They move to a first-floor apartment at Sachsenstrasse 42. Helmut misses the comfort of his grandparents next door, their quiet flat where he doesn't feel as though he's holding his breath, where he can escape to do his homework in peace. It's different for Hans and Gerhard. They're old enough to bicycle with their friends to Cuxhaven on the North Sea, where they camp overnight and dive for mussels that they cook on the beach. But Muti is happy, happier than Helmut ever remembers. She sings as she puts away the dishes, stacks the pots and pans beneath the sink, polishes the furniture. Her eyes glow as she tells Helmut that everything will work out just fine, that Hugo wants to be a father to him. "Wait and see," she says. "We will marry, and when we do, Hugo will adopt you. You will be his son." The thought turns Helmut cold inside. "I'm 12, going on 13," he says. "I don't need a father anymore." "Every boy needs a father," says Muti. "Gerhard and Hans do just fine without one," says Helmut. "And so do I." "Just promise me you'll give Hugo a chance," says Muti. "He wants what's best for you." A sensation of unease rises in Helmut's stomach, swims about. He doesn't like Hugo. He resents his presence in their flat. But he can't tell Muti no, And so he says, yes, for Mutti's sake. In 1938, Helmut graduates from primary school and starts at the Oberbau, the middle school at Brachdam. On his first day, Helmut carries his satchel into the classroom and sets it on a desk near the window. The schoolroom is plain, but the wall paint is fresh, and the wooden floorboards newly oiled and the desks worn. The room feels well lived in. A bright swastika flag hangs above the teacher's chair. Brand new textbooks sit, stacked on the desk. The other boys file in, most wearing Hitler Youth uniforms. The classroom grows noisy, and Helmut feels lost in the din. He doesn't know anyone, so he prefers to stay off to himself to take it all in. Suddenly, the classroom door slams shut, and the room falls silent. A short, trim man with fashionably slicked brown hair walks crisply to the front. He has wide shoulders and muscular arms. He turns on his heel and faces the class at attention like a soldier. The boys leap to their feet. They shoot their hands forward and cry out, "Heil Hitler!" It never feels right to say "Heil Hitler" instead of "good morning," but it's the rule, and so Helmut follows. The man raises his dark eyes to look at Adolf Hitler's portrait, as if invoking the Führer's blessing over his class. He then lifts his arm nonchalantly, a bored wave, it seems, and returns the Hitler salute. "Be seated," he says, and then he introduces himself as their new teacher, Herr Finke. "An exciting year awaits you," he says. "Never has there been a more exciting time to be young and to be a student. Thanks to the Führer, you will learn the new thinking in Germany." He thumps the textbooks with his knuckles. "The National Socialist Educational Program surpasses anything of its kind in history. You see, my boys, the reality is this. It is your job to shape the fate of our fatherland." Herr Finke picks up a stack of books and passes them out. "We will begin our study with the unlikeness of men," he says. This makes Helmut squirm inside, the same way he squirms when Hugo laughs over cartoons that depict Jews in an ugly manner. But the lesson isn't about race. It's about the different mental and spiritual traits of men, traits such as courage and honor and duty. These are questions that Helmut has often pondered at night when he lies in bed. Helmut grows more interested and listens intently. "For some, courage and loyalty are nothing but great stupidities," says Herr Finke. "They would rather be live cowards than dead heroes." Helmut reflects on those words. He knows he's loyal, but he wonders if he is also brave, if he has what it takes to be a hero. Herr Finke continues. "Others, however, cannot live without honor and prefer death to cowardice. They want their death to stand for something." He picks up a large scrolled print. He unrolls it and holds it out for the class to see. Helmut is intrigued by the sinking ship, by the drowning sailor who clings to the naval flag, by the debris floating about. Even as the sea rages around him, the brave sailor keeps the flag safely above him and the water. "This painting is called Fulfilling His Last Duty," says Herr Finke. "It illustrates one's duty to raise high the flag, to never let it fall. This is what it means to be a good German. A good German is loyal, honorable, brave, courageous, willing to sacrifice himself for his country." Helmut knows these things. He knows that a good German puts loyalty and self-sacrifice ahead of all personal interests. But there is something about the drowning naval soldier that bothers Helmut. He raises his hand to speak. Herr Finke calls on him, and Helmut stands. "Wouldn't it be better, sir, to grab a piece of the floating wood, even if it means letting go of the flag? This way, you might live to fight another day for your country." This enrages Herr Finke. He pinches his lips shut for a long moment, and when he finally speaks, his words are clipped and cutting. "Sit down. You have completely failed to understand a soldier's duty. The greatest honor for any soldier is to die for his country rather than to let the flag fall. For the flag represents the fatherland, and if the flag falls, Germany falls. Is that what you want?
No, sir, says Helmut. He feels embarrassed and confused.
You are a troublemaker. I should mark this down in your party record book, but I will not.
Instead, you have earned the class an extra homework assignment.
Herr Finke announces that the class must write a 500-word essay with the title Adolf Hitler, Savior of the Fatherland. Helmut's classmates cast angry glances at Helmut as they snap open their notebooks and copy down the title. Helmut tries to make sense of what just happened. He opens his notebook, dutifully copies down the assignment as anger swells inside him. Anger that Herr Finke misunderstood his question. Anger that Herr Finke now thinks him a coward. Anger and humiliation beat inside Helmut with a pulse all their own. That night, Helmut sits at the kitchen table, feeling dark, chewing on his pencil. His paper is blank except for its title and opening sentence. It wasn't fair the way Herr Finke twisted Helmut's question, the way Herr Finke made the whole class suffer. Now the entire class is angry at Helmut. And who can blame them? Helmut could kick himself for raising his hand for asking that question. Hugo Hubener comes up from behind. He rests his hand on Helmut's shoulder, startling him. Hugo's hand feels gentle but strong. Hugo leans over Helmut's shoulder and reads the first sentence out loud. God has blessed our fatherland by giving us Adolf Hitler. He squeezes Helmut's shoulder in approval. A good start, my boy. Helmut cringes. He hates it when Hugo calls him my boy. His homework mocks God, says Gerhard matter-of-factly. He doesn't look up from his physics book. Now 17, Gerhard has begun classes at the Technikum, where he studies electrical engineering. He's seldom home anymore, since he also works at the Mützenfabrik, a factory that makes stiff military hats, the kind with a visor in front. The long hours and hot, smelly work make him tired and cross. Helmut wishes his other brother were at home, too, to say what he thinks. But Hans is a shipbuilding apprentice at the dockyards, and Helmut rarely sees him at all. God and country go together, says Hugo. They do, says Gerhard. But that essay isn't about God and country. It makes an idol out of Hitler, and anyone who makes an idol out of a leader mocks God. It does not mock God, says Hugo. The fatherland is a gift to us from God, and God has blessed the fatherland by giving us a leader like Hitler, who has the strength and resolve to lead Germany out of this mess. You should honor your country, and that means honoring your leaders. Doesn't that church of yours teach you anything? Helmut feels anger rise inside at Hugo's biting remark. Hugo isn't a Mormon. How dare he criticize their church? Hugo doesn't even go to church, not even when Mutti pleads. Gerhard's eyes brighten the way they always do when he stands up to Hugo. I do honor my country, Hugo, the way my church tells me I should. Every day I honor my country by obeying, honoring, and sustaining its laws. I am a good German, no matter what I think of the Führer. Are you insulting the Führer? Demands Hugo. No, says Gerhard. I am insulting that essay. Helmut can't take their arguing anymore. He can't afford a bad grade or a bad mark in his party record book, because that would keep him from getting a good job later on. And so before Hugo can respond, Helmut smacks his hand against the table. It's my homework, he shouts, and I'll write what I need to write. Hugo and Gerhard stop arguing. They are surprised at Helmut's outburst. A savior is somebody who rescues someone or something from harm or danger, Helmut begins. That's what Hitler has done. He has rescued the fatherland from poverty, unemployment, and inflation, just as he promised he would. Hugo's eyes widen with pleasure, but Gerhard doesn't say a word. He stacks his books loudly and stalks to the door. He yanks the door handle hard and then lets the door slam behind him. The slamming door sounds like a pistol shot. Helmut looks to Muti, who is standing in the kitchen doorway. He wants her to say something, to defend Gerhard, because that's what mothers do for their children. But she doesn't. Suddenly, Helmut can't remember the last time she spoke up for one of them. Hugo always has the final word. And now Helmut feels just as cowardly. He didn't speak up for Gerhard either. Mutti's face crumples. She lowers herself onto the couch, buries her face in her hands.
Why can't you two let each other be? Why must you fight?
Hugo sits beside her, draws her to him, kisses the top of her head.
Men like to fight, he says. That's the way we are. It's in our blood. But don't worry. Gerhard will come around. You'll see.
And then to Helmut, Hugo beams.
But you, my boy, have the right attitude. A born leader, that's what you are. A man to watch. You will go far.
Helmut blocks out the sound of Hugo's praise. He doesn't feel like a leader, a man to watch. He squirms inside as he stares at the words, God has blessed our fatherland by giving us Adolf Hitler. Is Gerhard right? Does it make an idol out of Hitler? Does it mock God? Every day, it seems, the Nazis hang more portraits of Adolf Hitler. Town squares and buildings are renamed after him. They evoke his name in praise and even in prayers, giving thanks to the Führer for getting Germany back on its feet, for jobs, for the new factories that produce everything from tanks and airplanes and guns to the cheap people's radio. Helmut knows he's supposed to support his country and its leaders, and yet the Nazis feel dark and threatening, too. Every day, it seems, the Nazis pass more laws against the Jews. Helmut sees the terrible signs that read, Jewish swine, and Jews out, Jews die. In school, Helmut must pass tests that show he understands the differences between inferior races such as the Jews and the superior Aryan race. How does such meanness and hate build a better Germany? Helmut sits at the table, tapping his pencil impatiently as he wrestles with his feelings. Finally, he pushes them down and begins to write. He doesn't think about the meaning behind the words, just writes. Writes what Herr Finke wants to hear. Writes what will earn a high mark. The inside of Helmut's head feels like crashing cymbals. The words, the sentences, waver, bang apart, come back together again, until at last he's finished. He stares at the handwritten pages and feels worse than a coward. He feels like a traitor to his brother, but mostly a traitor to himself, a traitor to his true feelings. That night, Gerhard's side of the bed remains empty. Helmut turns on his stomach, then flops back again, thinks about Gerhard, of how sure he is of everything, even what he wants to do with his life. As Helmut drifts off to sleep, he wonders about his own future and what he has been put on this earth to do. Several days later, Herr Finke returns the graded essays. Helmut has earned a high mark, with only a brief comment. Well done. He stuffs the essay into his satchel and heads home. The satchel feels heavy, but not from the weight of books. It is heavy from the weight of the graded paper, the weight of Finke's praise. In spring 1938, Austria is reunited with Germany, and near the end of the school year, a Nazi official, an SS officer, accompanies Herr Finke to class. The official introduces himself as Asmus, the senior district director of the Hitler Youth in the Hammerbrook neighborhood. As you know, all eligible young people are required by law to join the Hitler Youth, Herr Asmus says crisply. It's your duty to serve the fatherland. Most of you already belong. I am here today to sign up stragglers. Helmut is the first to be called. He stands, wishes he could drop through the floor. There was a time when Helmut longed to join, but living with Hugo has changed all that. Herr Asmus looks down at his orderly notes. Name? He asks, though Helmut can see his name printed there, plain as day, in the non-member column. Helmut stands straight, arms at his side, takes a deep breath, says, Gudat, Helmut Gudat. The director asks general questions about Helmut's family and their political beliefs, which Helmut answers briskly. Nein, I am not a member of the Hitler Youth. Nein, my mother is not a communist. Ja, my mother's name is Emma Gudat Kunkel. My mother is divorced from her first husband, Johannes Kunkel. I have two older half-brothers, Hans and Gerhard Kunkel. My mother never married my father. Herr Asmus looks up at Helmut. A mocking smile crosses his face. She is engaged to marry Hugo Hubner, says Helmut. At this, Asmus arches one eyebrow and says, Hubner, you say? The Rotenführer? Ja. Asmus nods in approval. Ach ja, he says. The Rotenführer is a good Nazi. He pries no further. He scribbles a notation and then hands Helmut a paper to sign and another to get signed at home. Helmut takes the first paper and signs his name, assuring that he is 100% Aryan, not one drop of Jewish blood. He has the documentation to prove it for 6 generations. Welcome, says Asmus. Here's the address where your Kameradschaft meets. He slides a piece of paper toward Helmut. Report Wednesday at 7 o'clock sharp. Mutti doesn't fuss at all, and the next day Hugo surprises Helmut with a brown Jungfolk shirt and the 10 Pfennig for dues. Few men are born to lead. The rest are born to follow, he tells Helmut. You are a leader, my boy, I can tell. All that spring and into the summer, Helmut busies himself with the Jungfolk, its meetings and games and weekend hiking and camping trips. Oma and Opa complain when Helmut misses church, and that's something that Helmut misses too. But Hugo tells Oma and Opa that it's Helmut's duty. God expects young people to serve the fatherland, he says. It's one of the sacrifices young Germans must make for their country. He beams as he looks at Helmut. Isn't that right, my boy? The sound of feet ring outside Helmut's cell. A key turns in the lock and the door swings open. Helmut catches his breath, releases it slowly. It's the morning guard. Exercise time. Helmut picks up his slop bucket, carries it outside, waits his turn to empty it, hose it out. Everything feels magnified in the prison yard. The crisp autumn air, the grass, the trees, the leaves red, yellow, orange, the sky blue, clouds white, sun yellow. So much color, so much air, so much light, so much everything, it hurts. The guard barks a command. The prisoners trudge clockwise around the prison yard, marching single file on the worn path, their gray prison smocks billowing like the wings of birds. It's verboten to speak to other prisoners. Helmut keeps his head down, avoids their faces, doesn't want to see the new faces, or the missing faces after the executioner has done his work. He looks down at his thin legs, his knobby knees, his worn leather shoes, no shoelaces, the grass, the dirt. Thinks instead about his 2 best friends, Rudi Vobe and Karl Heinz Schnibbe. Sees Rudi's worried face, Karl's big grin, a face comfortable with smiling. The boys lived in different neighborhoods and attended different schools, but they belonged to the same Mormon church. There aren't many Mormons in Hamburg, and their church is housed in a factory building in the St. Georg district of Hamburg. It seemed as though the 3 boys were destined to be friends from the day they met in primary class at church. By summer 1938, the city parks have sprouted signs forbidding Jews to enter. Churches, too, for the Nazis declare that even Jews who convert to Christianity are still Jews. Such a sign is even posted at Helmut's church to protect the church from Jews. This is what the branch president says after he sees the Gestapo sitting in the back of the church taking notes. The Nazis watch everything, churches, schools, places people work. But church members protest and tear down the sign after 1 week. The Hitlerjuss Jungvolk meetings keep Helmut busy, and several weeks pass before Helmut sees his friend, Rudi Volba. When he does, it's by chance that they meet. Helmut is sitting on a park bench reading a detective novel. Rudi sits himself down next to Helmut. "Where have you been?" he asks. Helmut dog-ears the page and closes the book. "Jungvolk," he says. Rudi scowls. "You joined?" Helmut nods, and Rudi grows silent, giving the bobbing mallards his undivided attention. Helmut knows Rudi had a bad experience in the Jungvolk, that he quit after his squad had roughed him up. Karl Schnibbe's experience wasn't much better, except that Karl was expelled after he beat up his zealous platoon leader. Karl has no patience for Nazis. Or bullies. "So you're a Nazi now," says Rudi. Helmut stares at a pair of ducks circling each other, admires how smooth and unruffled they look, but beneath the water they're paddling furiously. "Hugo bought me the shirt and paid the dues," he says to Rudi. "I couldn't refuse. But don't mistake me for a Nazi. I'm nothing like Hugo." He doesn't want to tell Rudi that there are things he actually likes about the Jungvolk. The weekend hiking and camping trips that take him away from the Sachsenstrasse flat that feels so full of Hugo. There's also a special Hitler Youth section for older boys that intrigues him. The H.J. Streifendienst, a patrol force whose members act as junior Gestapo. He likes the idea of detective work, of working to serve and protect the public, but that doesn't make him a Nazi. If Helmut were a detective, he'd arrest real criminals, not the ordinary men and women who criticize Hitler or the Nazi Party and find themselves denounced by friends and neighbors. Helmut glances back at Rudi, can tell he's brooding. "You'd like this book," Helmut says, changing the subject. He reads the title out loud. "Lord Lister, Genannt Raffles, der große Unbekannte." It's about a gentleman thief who helps honest men ruined by swindlers. Silence. "The thief twists the law," says Helmut. "But he does so for honorable reasons, to bring dishonest men to justice. He robs the robbers."
"Like Robin Hood?" says Rudi.
"Exactly," says Helmut. Helmut has missed his friend, finds himself irritated that Jungvolk duty has kept them apart. Suddenly, Helmut is struck with an idea, one that will restore their friendship. "Rudi, we should start our own detective agency," he says. Rudi looks at him incredulously. "And play detective like children?" "No," says Helmut. "Have you not noticed all the unsolved crimes in the newspaper? The police say they need our help, that it's our duty to report suspicious activity."
"Do you mean spy on our neighbors?" Rudy's eyes narrow with disgust. "The Nazis have enough informers."
"No, real crimes. You know, robberies and murders."
"We can't do that. We're not old enough. The police will laugh at us."
"They won't laugh," says Helmut. "Not when they see that we can think like adults." He taps his head with his forefinger. "And we have an advantage. We're young, so criminals won't suspect us. We'll get more information that way."
"It's impossible," says Rudi. "You're talking about the Gestapo."
He shudders. "I'd rather steer clear of them. A lot of people disappear after the Gestapo visit." "I'm not afraid of the Gestapo," says Helmut. He straightens his shoulders and juts out his chin. "When we crack our first case, we'll be famous. Maybe they'll even offer us a reward or a job. Come on, it can't hurt to try." Helmut watches Rudy's face. Everything Rudi thinks shows on his face. Before Rudi says so, Helmut can see his face shift into agreement.
"Sure," says Rudi. "Okay. Why not? We'll be detectives."
The discomfort between the two friends has fallen away. Helmut crooks his arm around Rudy's neck.
"This will be fun."
The next day, Helmut hands Rudi a small card. The card reads, "Lord Lister Detective Agency." Rudi holds the card by its edges and whistles under his breath.
You made these yourself? They look real.
They are real, says Helmut. Rudy reads further. Helmut Gudat, Agent Number 1. Rudy Vobe, Agent Number 2. He grins, tucks his card into his wallet.
Come on, says Helmut. Let's go down to the police station and see what crimes they have for us.
Helmut and Rudy head north toward the local police station at Hammerdeich 57. An odd, watchful silence hangs over the foreboding brick building. They stand outside and watch as four SS men exit the front doors, green files tucked under their arms, striding toward Gravenweg. Two other men, wearing the coats and hats of Gestapo agents, stride past without even a glance at the boys. Helmut thought about wearing his Hitler Youth uniform, but settled upon wearing good brown trousers and a white shirt. The trousers and shirt make him look more grown up. He walks crisply to the heavy wooden door and pulls it open.
Maybe this isn't such a good idea, says Rudy, firmly rooted on the sidewalk. He is also dressed in his best dark trousers and a white shirt.
Come on, urges Helmut. You don't have to say a word. I'll do the talking.
What are you going to say?
I don't know. I'll figure it out inside. Rudy traipses behind Helmut. The foyer feels cool and dark as they walk down the hall, reading the gold-lettered names and titles on the doors. Helmut stops outside a detective's office and reads the name, Inspector Becker. It seems as good as any other name. Helmut turns the doorknob. A blonde secretary sits at a gleaming wooden desk. Helmut introduces himself, asks to speak with Inspector Becker. She hesitates, but Helmut tells her that he and Rudy wish to do their duty as citizens. She leaves her desk, raps on the door behind her, and disappears inside. When she returns, she ushers the boys into a wood-paneled office that smells of cigarette smoke. A balding man, with strands of dark hair combed carefully across his head, sits behind another wooden desk, polished to a sheen, that reflects the glow of the lamp. With his white shirt and red bow tie, Inspector Becker looks more like a banker than an inspector. He sets a green folder flat on the desk blotter, motions to a pair of dark leather chairs. The boys sit, and Becker leans back. He thrums the tips of his fingers together, smiles thinly, and says, "So, you boys are here to do your duty as citizens." Herr Becker has a broad, blunt face, and Helmut notes that his eyes don't match his smile.
"Yes, sir," he says.
The smile fades.
"Do you have information for me? Perhaps you know somebody who is breaking the law? A neighbor or a relative or teacher, perhaps? Something you've overheard, some suspicious activity?"
"No, sir, nothing like that. My partner and I," Helmut nods at Rudy, "want to help the police solve crimes." Becker's expression changes, grows less pleasant.
"I am a busy man with no time to waste with childish games."
He picks up a folder, taps it against the desk, sticks it on top of a short stack of files.
"This isn't a game, sir," says Helmut. "We think like adults, even better than adults, and because we're..."
He starts to say children, catches himself, starts over, says,
"Because we're young, adults let their guard down. They're less cautious about what they say. That works to our advantage."
Becker's chair squeaks as he sits back, eyes Helmut, then Rudy carefully.
"I consider myself a good judge of people," he says at last. "You're smart, curious, not afraid to take initiative. I'll bet you can put two and two together."
Helmut leans forward.
"We can."
Inspector Becker tugs open a desk drawer, fingers through several files, takes out a slim folder, spreads it open on his desk. He thumbs through newspaper clippings, pulls one out.
"Here's an open case. A streetwalker was murdered in Rothenburgsort."
Helmut looks wide-eyed at Rudy, at the luck of it all, then back at the inspector.
"We know that neighborhood," Helmut thumbs at Rudy. "That's where my partner lives."
The inspector nods.
"See what you can find out. Let me know."
He pours himself a cup of coffee, offers one to Helmut and Rudy. Helmut shakes his head and says, "No thanks." Mormons don't drink coffee, though Helmut likes its deep, rich smell. Inwardly, he feels pleased that Becker asked. It's a sign that the inspector takes him seriously. Over the next several days, Helmut and Rudy prowl the Rothenburg sort streets, engaging the local shopkeepers and customers in conversation about the night of the stabbing. Helmut keeps careful notes. He jots down each detail, no matter how small or insignificant. Afterward, he and Rudy put the details together, shaping a story, tracing the streetwalker's last night. At a small dark pub along the Auschlager Allee, they make a significant discovery. In the smoky room filled with customers who wear the cloth caps of working men, a barmaid whispers a name, Franz Seemann. She had seen him talking to the streetwalker just a few nights before the murder. Helmut senses Rudy's excitement, and he elbows a gentle warning to remain composed. Helmut nods and thanks the barmaid, then nudges Rudy outside. "I know that man," says Rudy excitedly. "He's an unemployed dock worker. He's always looking for handouts and a free drink. Do you think we have a suspect?" "I don't know. We only have a name. But at least we have information for Inspector Becker, something for him to go on." The boys hurry to the Hammerdike station and report their findings. "Unemployed, you say?" says Inspector Becker, looking pleased. "At a time when Hitler has jobs for everyone. Sounds like a suspicious character, possibly an anarchist. There are those people who want to undermine this great country. All mentally unstable, if you ask me. In need of rehabilitation." Helmut's insides tighten at hearing this. He realizes something that frightens him. Inspector Becker seems to have already found Franz Seemann guilty. But Inspector Becker shakes their hands and assures them they did the right thing. He will send two agents to pick up Franz Seemann and bring him in for questioning. 2 days later, Helmut and Rudy stop by the police station, and Inspector Becker tells them that Seemann is in prison where he belongs. Becker pumps their hands again, congratulates them for helping to solve the case, promises to keep them in mind if he has other cases for them to solve. Helmut pushes down the unease he feels. Surely he hasn't accused an innocent man. Surely Inspector Becker would not allow that to happen. But still, the unease is there, that nagging feeling. The next time Helmut sees Rudy, Rudy's left arm is bandaged from wrist to elbow. "What happened?" Helmut asks. "An accident," says Rudy. And he tells Helmut how he had been playing chase with other boys from his street, and how he fell through a window, shattering the glass and severing an artery in his wrist. Rudy was rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery. Helmut whistles in stunned sympathy. "That wasn't the worst part," says Rudy. "I had two visitors from the Gestapo."
"The Gestapo? What did they want?"
"To investigate me. The nurses went through my wallet and found the Lord Lister card. They reported me as a potential enemy agent." Helmut snorts.
"You? An enemy agent?"
Rudy snaps at Helmut. "It's not funny. They wanted to know who Lord Lister was. Wanted to know why I worked for a British detective agency."
"Did you tell them it was a game? A made-up game?"
"Of course. But the one agent slapped me hard. He said it was no game to them. He warned me that they take subversive activity very seriously. The second agent wanted to know if it was a cover-up for a secret underground movement." Helmut's insides twist. He does not want to be in trouble with the Gestapo. Rudy looks ready to cry. "They fired question after question at me. They took my words, twisted them, and used them against me. They wanted to know what adults were involved."
"This is unfair," says Helmut.
"A Gestapo badge is not a license to abuse innocent people." Rudy quiets him. "I told them to ask Inspector Becker, that he would know who I am. The men wrote his name down and then said they'd check out my story. And for my sake, I'd better not be lying. I'll never forget the look in their eyes, like they enjoyed scaring me. And then they said, 'We'll find out the truth, we always do.' They took my wallet and my Lord Lister card with them.
This is insane, says Helmut. We wanted to help the police, and now they've turned on us.
Rudy nods.
They were trying to trip me up, trying to get me to say something that wasn't true, trying to get me to give information about somebody else, anything at all. They wrote it all down.
Let them take notes, says Helmut. All the notes they want. What do we care? We don't know anything that can hurt anyone.
I don't ever want to go through anything like that again.
You won't, says Helmut. Inspector Becker will straighten them out. That's the last you'll see of the Gestapo.
I hope so, says Rudy. I felt so scared, so guilty, even though I'd done nothing wrong.
Helmut wishes there were something more he could say, something he could do to help Rudy. But at this moment, he feels helpless.
Exercise time ends. The guard barks another command. Helmut retrieves his slop bucket, trudges back to his cell, sets the slop bucket in the corner. It's time to clean. Helmut takes his time, stretches out each task to pass the morning. He dusts the table, the chair, the floor, the corners, especially the corners. Dust is verboten. Helmut winces, doesn't want to think about the punishment that dust brings. As he cleans, he wonders about Franz Seemann, wonders if he was truly guilty, wonders how he held up under the Gestapo interrogation he certainly received. Helmut knows all about Gestapo interrogations now. He knows that prisoners will say anything, admit to anything to make the torture stop. He wishes he could tell Franz Seemann how sorry he is. Helmut digs vigorously at the dust in the corner. The summer of 1938 turns to crisp fall. The Germans are upset at stories that Czechs and Poles are abusing ethnic Germans living in Czechoslovakia and Poland. Hitler orders troops to the border of Czechoslovakia, sending a strong warning to those who dare to mistreat Germans. He demands a Sudetenland where many Germans live, and gets his way. Helmut and Rudy never hear from Inspector Becker again. The police are too busy arresting Polish Jews living in Germany, cramming them into trains, shipping them back to Poland.
"Have you seen the long lines of Jews at the train station?" says Hugo one night in late October.
"A good thing. We've got too many Jews as it is. No need to keep the Polish ones, too."
"Too many Jews," says Gerhard. "Germany has 60 million people, and out of that 60 million, only 500,000 are Jews."
"And look at the trouble those 500,000 have caused," says Hugo matter-of-factly.
"How many Jews do you know?" asks Helmut quietly.
Hugo thinks over his answer.
"None. And now, thanks to our Führer, I will soon know even fewer." He chuckles at his own joke. "No one wants the Jews, not even America. Americans have no right to criticize us. They rounded up their Indians, you know, put them on reservations."
Helmut pities the Polish Jews who are herded onto trains, shipped back to Poland, but feels sorrier still when Poland doesn't want them back. At the border, Polish authorities deny the Jews entry and detain them in open fields without shelter, food, or water, while the Polish and German governments argue. After several tense days, the Polish government agrees to a compromise. Poland takes some of the Jews, and the rest are shipped back to Germany.
"A great victory," says Hugo. "We have shown Poland that they cannot dictate policy to us. Germany is for Germans, true Germans."
The November weather turns colder, the sky always dark and gray. Hamburg is beautiful nonetheless, with its rivers and canals, craggy spires and turrets. And for a city that had been so poor before Hitler's rise to power, the sound of work, of hammers ringing along the docks, building ships and U-boats, is beautiful too. There's excitement in Germany, prosperity, pride in everything German. But there's tension too, and on November 7th, the radio crackles with news reports about a young Jew named Herschel Grunspan, who has shot a Nazi official, Ernst von Rott, in Paris. A fever grips the German people as they learn that the official lies near death in a Paris hospital.
"It's a plot," rages Hugo, "a cowardly plot.
Another Jewish plot to bring Germany to its knees, to cripple the fatherland.
How can you call it a plot? Asks Helmut. It's one 17-year-old boy who shot one Nazi.
But Hugo won't listen. Mark my words, it's a plot.
The next day, to prove his point, Hugo waves the Nazi party newspaper, the Völkischer Beobachter, with its thick black headlines that cry, Outrage! World Jewry attacks!
See, he says, I was right. And the Jews will pay for their cowardly act.
Two nights later, Mutti is cleaning dinner dishes in the kitchen sink as Hugo dresses. The radio is on, has been on for 2 days, so Hugo can listen and sputter and shout about the news. Hugo shrugs into his thick black coat, picks up his SS hat. He nuzzles Mutti's neck. Be careful. Don't go out tonight, he says. And don't wait up. There's a dangerous glint in Hugo's eyes. Hugo leaves. Helmut stands at the window, watches as Hugo crosses to the corner. It's drizzling. The black pavement gleams wet. The street is quiet. Oddly quiet. No police, no pedestrians. Just the distant rumble of a streetcar. Under the gas lamp, Hugo greets several men. All are wearing uniforms. They stand proudly, as if their uniforms make them something. Two are so drunk they lean against each other. The night seems ordinary enough, just a bit darker than usual, a bit quieter. Mutti calls Helmut from the window. She has changed the radio station, and a Wagner opera now fills the flat. Come dry, she says to Helmut, pressing a dish towel into his hand. As Helmut dries the last dish, the Wagner opera is interrupted. A newscaster breaks in with a special report. The Nazi official, Ernst vom Rath, has died. After that, the night explodes. Helmut hears distant shouts, crashing, splintering, the roar of engines. Trucks come and go all night. The next morning, just as Gerhard and Helmut finish breakfast, Hugo stumbles in the door. The smell of smoke hangs on his coat. There's a strange look of feverish excitement in his bloodshot eyes, making them a sharper and brighter blue. Mutti brings him two soft-boiled eggs in blue egg cups and a thick slice of rye toast. Hugo grabs a knife, hatchets off the top of his eggs. He dunks the bread in the runny yolks and gobbles it down. Hugo turns on the radio. In full cry, the newscaster erupts with the details of spontaneous riots against the Jews that have taken place all over Germany. It's all in retribution for the Jew who killed the Nazi official in Paris. Synagogues are burned down or nearly demolished. Jewish shops, stores, businesses, and private homes ransacked and destroyed. Jews arrested and trucked away. It's terrible, says Mutti. She touches Hugo's neck, folds down the collar of his shirt.
I agree, it's not pretty, says Hugo. People do terrible things when they're angry. But Jews must learn that they can't get away with murder.
Hugo finishes the second egg and his toast. He sucks the egg from his mustache, pushes away from the table, and heads to the bedroom. He collapses with a groan on the bed. Mutti follows him, and from the kitchen, Helmut watches as she tugs off his boots, draws the blanket over him. Helmut wrestles a sudden wave of nausea as he realizes what Hugo did last night. But it's Gerhard who says something when Mutti returns.
How can you? He whispers to Mutti. You heard the news. How can you not say anything?
Mutti bites her lip, doesn't answer for a long while, and when she does, she speaks without looking at her sons. Silence is how people get on sometimes. I don't expect you to understand. Helmut's disgust turns to pain for his mother and disgust for himself. He recognizes silence. He's silent every night around Hugo. Every day at school, when Herr Finke says terrible things about Jews. Every meeting with the Jungfolk, when they play games like Capture the Jew. Gerhard stalks out. Helmut leaves, too. He heads toward school and then changes his mind and turns toward the Grindel district. Nothing prepares him for what he sees, the work of Hugo and his Nazi friends, the ruined shops and businesses, the burned-out buildings, the smoldering synagogue, its colorful glass windows shattered. The looters, their arms heaped with clothing, shoes, everything they can carry.